The SGGQA podcast is brought to you in part by One More. Treat your ears. One More's mission is to bring innovation, design, and quality to all music lovers, young or old, frugal or spendy. Offering an incredible collection of earbuds at all tiers of the market, cabled or Bluetooth, neckband or true wireless. Fantastic sound quality, top-tier tuning, excellent noise reduction. I've personally been a fan for a couple years now. Right now, my headphone of choice is the Dual Driver ANC Pro neckband. Great battery life, punchy dynamic sound, and crazy good noise reduction in a very convenient just drop your earbud neckband design. Or you can get those same features and completely cut the cords with the Dual Driver ANC True Wireless, one of the absolute best options in the completely cable-free space. Or maybe you want to fill a decently large room with a pair of One More portable Bluetooth speakers. There's a whole collection of great audio options for you to shop at affordable prices. And for listeners of this podcast, I can also do you one better. If you shop at onemore.com, use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY10 at checkout. Once again, SOMEGADGETGUY10 with no spaces. You'll save an additional 10% over their already competitive prices. You'd spend over $80 less on One More's Dual Driver ANC True Wireless compared to that other brand's Pro earbuds. You know who I'm talking about. One More brings style, premium audio quality, and cool tech features to the table at prices that won't hurt the wallet. You can check out these multiple award-winning audio solutions at onemore.com. And remember to use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY10 at checkout to save some scratch. Now, let's get on with the show. All right, I believe this means we are live. We are live. There's my voice. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions, welcome to another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I'm Juan Carlos Bagnell, a.k.a. Some Gadget Guy, the SGG of this horribly named podcast series. The important part, though, when we say SGGQA, is obviously the QA, which is something that I really want to try and focus on more this week. I said last week, I wanted to do kind of a chill pajama chat, you know, like anything you guys want to talk about, guys, gals, and, you know, all tech fans included. And I rambled on through a ton of the news block and some decent stories in the gadget block and never really got around to some proper Q&A. Like, we answered one question at 2.5 hours into the podcast. So, with my voice being a little fragile, I did a lot of talking last week to not get out a lot of videos. I'm not going to be doing the same split where I normally do a whole bunch of political news and tech news, and then we do like a second half gadget block. I'm going to smash all of the news stories into one block, and then I kind of just want to hang out and chat. There's been a lot of stuff going on in the world of tech. We're in between sort of the fall product releases from a number of other companies. We're starting to see some refreshes. There's some interesting things happening. You know, like at OnePlus, one of the main stories we've got to talk about is OnePlus canceling the 9T. And really, I'd kind of like just to have a bit more of a dialogue this week. So with that in mind, And last week, I think I did a pretty good job of like chewing through housekeeping and stuff. I want to try and do the same thing here too. Kind of abbreviate my normal morning patter. And Dave Burns, I completely agree. I can't wait to see the Pixel. Yes. I mean, at this point, I don't even know what to say about the Pixel anymore. I want it so bad. All right. Why don't we kick in? First of all, happy Monday. I'm so happy to see already, that main crew, Dave Burns, Aditya, Gabaletta, Dustadori, Mr. Malignance, Kappa Cash, Gary the Fireman, Streamy Boys, Vazikos 8, already seeing this is the kind of roster that I would want to jump into a Monday tech chat with. I hope everyone had a lovely and phenomenal weekend. Lex had her second soccer camp on Sunday, and it was adorable watching a bunch of 5 and 6 year olds play magnet ball. Because the coach is trying to say, well, today we're going to work on passing. And then he would kind of roll the ball out there, and then four girls would just go, and then just attack the ball, which was kind of beautiful, because I can vaguely remember my early soccer experiences being very similar. And then, really, it's just, there's a lot of craziness going on in the world, so let's keep this one comfy. Let's keep this one chill, and we'll just have a little fun. We'll have a little fun this week, because you know what? One of the things that I'm kind of tired of doing, and this is going to lean into some of the housekeeping, is I obviously have a reputation for being a crank, and I kind of know my reputation follows me, especially when people talk about my content, like on Reddit. Totally understand. That's my bag. That's kind of what I'm good at, and I like picking apart bad arguments. That's not going to win you a lot of friends in the broader, more populous, commentary communities. I kind of keep going through these cycles. And this is another one of those cycles where it's like, I personally need to find a bit more what is making me happy about this stuff. Because otherwise, it's just going to be misery. You see some folks getting out there like, oh my gosh, I'm so hyped out of my mind for this new phone release. And I hope it's true. I hope that techie or influencer or reviewer genuinely feels that way. Because otherwise, that level of energy and acting to not feel that way would be misery. I would never wish that on any, even my least favorite content creators out there. So let's knock out some housekeeping. Of course, everything that we're going to be talking about, all of the news links, all of the story links, and all of the housekeeping links will be available on the show notes once the audio version of this podcast goes live, somegadgetguy.com. And I want to kick it over because one of the reasons why I don't want to get too deep or too heavy on this week's episode is because I kind of already did it. I already fed the YouTube algorithm thirst trap. And I did it on this video here. iPhone 13. I'm not buying one. The only description that I put, I'm not going to buy the iPhone 13. I won't be reviewing the iPhone 13. If you're curious why, let's chat. And why this is so frustrating is I've been trying to create videos that I'm personally more interested in. Camera explainers, tips and tricks, some evergreen content, like how to get the most out of your products. And those videos will spike 1,000 views and then long tail die. Just YouTube just kills them. There is nothing worth sharing in any of those videos, in any of those tutorials. You would never want to educate your audience. How dare you? I put iPhone 13 in the title of this video, and it hit 30,000 views in the first hour it was published. If I needed any better evidence that YouTube is against any kind of broader or more nuanced commentary, it's this video right here. All they wanted was the most immediate, timely video content, tentpole search engine optimization type of video title. And it sent this video out super aggressively. And I can also track like where it's riding high. It's getting tons of views, tons of views, tons of views. And then as a few other people were able to craft their reactions, it just craters. And that video just stops getting sent out. Oh, there are other people now putting out videos, and now YouTube can send those videos out to other channels. I don't have to use that some gadget guy cranky video. YouTube is toxic. It's proper toxic. You can pour your heart and soul into well-researched, informative, educational content, and you can cut 2 zeros off of the number of views that you'll get on that. All I need to do is sit in front of a video and put, the most popular keyword of that moment and just talk to camera, dry, no B-roll. YouTube will love it! Just send it out to everybody. Oh, we'll finally send one of your videos out to all your subscribers. You finally figured out that popular content is what you should be making. So I also just wanted to highlight this for a little bit longer in housekeeping because I shot this video before the Apple announcement. I was so confident Apple would not address my concerns, and I had so little faith in Apple that I had this ready to go before the announcement so I could push publish as soon as it was finished to see that they didn't address my issues with their stance on privacy. I mean, like, if you need any better evidence that early access is a huge financial perk, embargo videos are an enormous financial perk. It doesn't matter if a content creator or reviewer says, I wasn't influenced or paid to share my thoughts about this. BS, you were. If you got early access, if you got an embargo device, you got a ton of a financial incentive to play ball with that company. So, moving right along. Oh no, I've got to mute someone here. Actually, you know what? I'm just going to ban. Anytime I see one of these, hey, do you want to be famous on Twitch? Kinds of comments, I'm just going to ban them. The other major piece of video that I put out, don't upgrade your phone just for a better camera. And this goes hand in hand with my how tech reviewers get cameras wrong editorial. And I did a sort of a video companion piece to this talking about how we kind of hype train. We kind of explode on new camera announcements. Like, oh my gosh, did you see the iPhone 13? It's going to be getting an all new camera and it's going to be so much better than the previous camera. But we don't really test for what they're claiming when they talk about a new sensor or a new design. So trying to isolate all of the other variables of computational photography, of different pixel binning arrangements, and all of the other pieces and parts that go into making a camera, I tried to whittle this down to only focus on the arguments made when people talk about sensor size. So if you want, with math and showing my work. See, this is what's so frustrating. I showed my work. I spent days verifying all of my numbers, all of the math, double checking all of the computations to properly showcase, picking the right phones to show examples of this is what you get from this one sensor size, another sensor size, a larger sensor size. And of course, I made two hilarious typos in that video when talking about like sensors. I don't know what it is. I have the hardest time representing fractions, and in my brain, 1/1 doesn't make any sense. I don't know what it is. It's this hard mental block. So anytime I had a sensor that was larger than a half inch, that's a 1/1 point something sensor. Like if you had 1/1, that's just a one inch sensor. Every other phone that had a larger than half inch sensor managed to goof somewhere in that video, mislabeling the sensor size. But I got the math right, and I was showing the right comparisons. I labeled them incorrectly, so I'm good at what I do. Moving right along, we had a banger show, TK and I, for Best of Our Week. Again, if you want sort of the more in-depth and the more positive spin on what Apple might have put out there, we really wanted someone on that. I feel that he gets a bit more philosophical with his tech reviewing than the average bear. We had Josh Vergara and Issa Does Tech. Josh and Issa joined us for Best of Our Week. And I love the keywords that TK put in the title. iPhone 13, 13 mini, 13 Pro, 13 Pro Max, Xiaomi 11T, 11T Pro, Vivo X70 Pro Plus. YouTube thirst trap. We don't want to have to do things like that. But you gotta. It's the only way you get any kind of attention from YouTube. Oh, please, YouTube, validate my experience. And then lastly, one of the major projects, and I was so happy
to be a part of this one, because I'm intermittently still doing some work with Newegg. I'm not one of their contract hosts like I used to be, but I like to be able to show up and contribute to a conversation on tech that I really enjoy. Usually that's more like components. So when Asus launches a new range of motherboards, I jump into a stream and we chat for 3 hours about like new motherboard technologies. But this one was near and dear to my heart and I was so stoked to be a part of it. It was an NVIDIA partnership with Newegg to chat about NVIDIA Broadcast. And anyone rocking an RTX GPU, I believe RTX 2060 on up, you can jump on this free software that does an incredible job of filtering out background noise. It gives you all these fun like camera tricks that you can mess with, background replacement, background blur, et cetera, et cetera. Really, really sweet. I've been using it for a bit just to see if anyone would kind of notice, like when the air conditioner kicks on or when a truck rumbles by, and it's real good. It does the job very well. I've even been able to like keep fans running in my office while producing content just so that I don't like completely melt on camera. So that one was really great. And we actually had one of the product engineers responsible for developing it. I talked about this early last year when the first beta of RTX Voice came out. And it's still stupid to me that this works as well as it does. I mean, like, it's one step removed from magic. Because it's kind of like noise reduction in your headphones, but its ability to scalpel out noise, highlight the human voice, and return that level of processing in almost zero lag conditions doesn't make any sense to me. Like, it's the quality paired with that immediate return, that near zero latency return. I don't get it. I really don't. I don't understand how that can work. But it does, and it works really well. So the reason why I'm also highlighting this, because I don't always talk about all of my Newegg streams here on the podcast, I'd like folks to know that the Newegg Ninjas are giving away an MSI laptop, one of the creator-badged laptops with an RTX GPU. And if you go and check out that video, there are links in that description to take you to a contest page. I believe the contest is going to be running for another couple days. So if you're catching this on broadcast day, or if you're catching this as part of the replay crew, you've got time to go try and score yourself a baller laptop. And if you want to see my thoughts on that laptop, it's a variation on the Creator 15 that I reviewed on my own YouTube channel. And it's real nice. It's not a gaming laptop. And I think that's what's so interesting, is kind of whittles back on that idea of, for me, when I was starting to do a lot of mobile production, we were looking at these insane workstation laptops, and they were prohibitively expensive to get like a video editing rig in a clamshell portable. And so most of us were rocking gaming laptops as this kind of interim step where we knew we could get a dedicated GPU. We knew it was going to handle video editing software better. And now there's something kind of in between. The Creator laptop can play games well. It's got a good RTX GPU in there, but it's not a gaming laptop. This is a work machine. Excuse me. But it doesn't cross over into that kind of more ultra premium tier workstation grade kind of setup. I mean, again, it's kind of tricky to delineate, but this is why I get really excited about laptops again, is because we can make those distinctions. You know, like, we can't have a workstation phone. We can't have a pro content creation phone. We've only begrudgingly allowed the market to include more gaming phones. You know, it's so silly to watch laptops find this kind of renaissance, and then look at phones and be like, is it a premium phone or a mid-ranger? Brr. Yeah, that's so regressive. So that's gonna do it here for housekeeping. It was a great week. It wiped me out. I did so much talking, so I'm going to drink just a little bit of water right now. Raymond, it made it. So, welcome. And let's see. Oh, Aditya, that's really kind. Hold on, I just want to highlight this. Where did Aditya's comment go? that conversation was awesome. Again, it's one part just to say, like, I think this is cool. It's another part to say, like, this is a really cool idea. It's accessible to older hardware because I'm not running a current RTX. I'm running a 2080, so I'm not even on, like, the cool hip 3060s or anything like that. But it was also just demonstrating it live. Everything that failed in that live stream was not the broadcast software. The broadcast software actually kind of saved our butts, which is great to demonstrate, like, our live stream came just up to the edge of total failure, but the things that worked was the software that we were talking about. And then at the same time, to have someone intimately responsible for helping to create the software share his thoughts on the application, the inspiration, the inception of it. I mean, that to me is just like a really successful kind of product highlight. We know what product highlights are. NVIDIA wants you to buy their GPUs. If you've got this amazing GPU and it's just sitting there, why not use it for a Zoom call? Why not use it for a Skype call? Why not use it for a live stream? Why not use it for anything else and really get your money's worth? And I'm always going to be a fan of that conversation. I love $1,000 phones, but only if you have $1,000 worth of use to throw at that $1,000 phone. And yes, NVIDIA broadcast is kind of like magic. And from Russ, RTX voice is insane. So not only, I mean, because I was, when they approached us to do the update, I didn't even know broadcast was out. I had heard the announcement, hey, we're going to start working with some video features too. I was like, okay, cool. But I still had RTX voice installed when they came to me to host this. And so if you're still on RTX voice, flip it to broadcast. Yeah, I mean, it's the same RTX voice plugin with, I think, better speaker management. So the audio that's coming to you, you can also run the RTX voice filter on that just like you could, but I think it's improved. And all of the new camera tricks, all of the new camera features. So, you know, even if you're just trying to rock a video call with your folks on a laptop webcam, which would normally be pretty garbage, try it because it's surprisingly good. All right, let me catch up with the chat. Yeah, Raymond, exactly. More power only counts if you use it. I love people who are like, wait a minute, why is Android using up all my RAM? Why do you have RAM? If you're not going to use the RAM, why have it? You put stuff in the RAM. So, I don't know why it's so funny to me. I need 12 gigabytes of RAM, but I want it all open and free. All right. Let's move on to some news. Once more, somegadgetguide.com, all of the show notes and links, and we'll get into the to this news block here. Like I said, I'm mixing together. There's going to be a little political news, a little gadget news, and then I want to really dig in to some Q&A here. So starting off, these kinds of stories I think are important to highlight when we start talking about the differences in ecosystems. Android versus iOS is currently the only debate, which is boring. It's super boring. I am desperate for another flavor of Linux in mobile, of, you know, Kai OS. Give me an update so that I can know what's going on with ultra low cost smart computing, mobility, blah, 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 blah. But there's still this kind of geek generational idea that updates can only be one thing, this massive OTA that you get from the manufacturer, and that represents support. And I think what Google is doing needs to be highlighted in a more sort of progressive frame of mind. So, Android 11 has a feature where when you don't use apps for a while, it removes what do we call that? The permissions. So you give an app permission to use your location or your camera or your microphone. You don't use it for a while, Google is going to pull those permissions, and it's just going to make you re-verify that you do still want to use, you let that app use your hardware. That feature, I think, versions of that arrived earlier, but Android 11, that's really a forward consumer-facing feature. Well, that feature is going to be coming back to older versions of Android all the way back to Android 6. This is written up by Igor over at Engadget.com. When Google launched Android 11 at the end of last summer, it added a feature that automatically reset app permissions. Starting in December 2021, Google will begin rolling out that functionality to all devices running Android 6 and above. Company announced today in a developer update, the feature will come courtesy of a Google Play Services update. The company will roll out to billions of devices. And Google Play Services actually just got a refresh too. Can someone remind me what is, what it's like Android Intelligence or something like that? If someone can drop me a comment, I'll highlight the comment. But this is the new framework. Instead of a massive OTA, Google puts out a new update or a bug fix or a patch for Android. And then that goes to a manufacturer. And a manufacturer has to throw their skin on it and all their custom software and manipulate it, blah, 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 blah. And then here in the United States, that goes to the carriers. Then the carriers have to kind of finagle it and mess with it. And then if the carriers don't like it, they send it back to the manufacturer and they have to, you know, sort of re-finagle it. And eventually it gets passed down to consumers. And carriers also can be responsible for sort of sitting on some of this stuff. Because I remember, like, especially back in the G8 V50 days, LG updates in South Korea were coming much, much faster. Even the carrier branded South Korean phones. And then we would kind of see like, oh yeah, there's this beta LG update just sitting at Sprint. The Android 10, one of the major Android 10 updates sat at Sprint for like 2 additional months. It's just not much of an incentive to support that phone because fewer consumers are on it, which is incorrect. Sprint should have said, hey, this was a $1,000 phone. It doesn't matter if only 10 people bought it. We're Sprint and we are going to give them a premium tier experience. They spent $1,000 with our company, so we're going to treat them as such. That's not what happened. Yeah, that was bad. I'm not too sad to be losing Sprint now. Way back when I was on the Cero plan, the Sprint employee referral plan. And that was pretty sweet. That was a really good deal back in the early days of 3G data. I'm good on MVNOs. I know I'm not getting all the fun trade-in perks and stuff, but I mean, I've got dirt cheap data on Mint, and that's good enough for me. So anyway, the reason why I want to highlight this is there's another article that literally, I mean, I just saw it in my news feed. New features of, what is it? I think it says like many new features in iOS 15 will not be going to the iPhone XS or older devices or something like that. And I really want to showcase that. When we're talking about operating system fragmentation, it is still an issue in Android. It definitely is. I mean, the more complicated relationship between operating system developer and end user means that you don't have the same ease of update. But I don't think it's ever highlighted enough that increasingly the new features we're excited about in Android are coming directly to consumers versus Apple really just giving you security patches. So like iOS 15, if you don't have all the new features of iOS 15, what did you get? Yeah, you got iOS 15, but mostly that's just a collection of security patches, bug fixes, and kind of the new coat of paint that operating system is going to arrive with. An iPhone XS still doesn't have night mode capture in the camera, even though it's this ridiculously powerful A-series processor and a camera sensor that's supposedly better than a Pixel 3a that launched the same year that has a better camera than what's on the iPhone XS. So again, it's this kind of of lazy understanding of how all the parts move around. And it's one of the things that I'm most critically excited about in Android land is seeing, I can't remember what it's called. I gotta see. This is gonna drive me nuts because I just saw the update for it and it's like some funky new name. And I don't even think it's gonna be in my recently updated app. Android System Intelligence. Okay, so this Google Play Services is, I believe, now called Android System Intelligence. There was, a week ago, there was a 100-megabyte update just for this subsystem that's going to work with Google Play to better distribute Android software. So Android features, Android settings. This is the same mechanism that we got Nearby Share. So the AirDrop, Android version of AirDrop, came to significantly older phones through this mechanism. And now it looks like our ability to reset permissions, likewise, is coming directly to consumers, not going through a carrier OTA. All right. I just got a question here. I want to check it out. Trey writes, hey Juan, are you ever going to look into something like the Calyx OS AOSP fork? Is that even on your radar? That one is not. What I was looking at was actually spending a little bit more time with Lineage. I really wanted to see like some of this ridiculous collection of older phones that I've got, like how many of them I might be able to kind of bump up to a newer version of Android. And then also, I teased this a couple weeks back, and I'm probably not going to be able to do it right in the midst of new phones launching. I've got some embargo accessories that I can't talk about just yet. I'm going to be hosting a few other live streams for a couple other larger companies. I'm going to be a little stuck for free time on this, but especially as we get kind of closer to the holidays, in the sort of spirit of consumerism, I want to spend some time actually sitting in front of that phone museum. I want to spend some time just detailing one phone that I thought was important. And then looking at like, hey, this is a phone from 6 years ago. What's really changed? Because on a lot of these devices, it's not as much as you think. And if we could find, you know, a way like Lineage or maybe one of these other AOSP forks, it's never going to be consumer accessible. I know we nerds love to kind of think and tinker with flashing ROMs and stuff, but I don't know. I just get stuck. My mom, as a computer scientist, is probably never going to want to flash a ROM, an unofficial ROM on her phone and deal with her own support for that. But I just, the idea that these devices should be longer lived than they currently are just drives me crazy. Hey, TrendNet, I have a lot of thoughts about the framework. Hit me up once we get through some of these other news chats. And speaking of, let's get through a few more news pieces. One of the reasons why this longer idea of support is so important to me is because we also have to have those frank conversations about hardware support. There was a recent, another one of these kind of, just a regular clickbait or karma farming kind of post over on LifePro. Was it Life Pro Hacks? One of the subreddits about Life Pro tips, something like that. Hey, if you're thinking about buying a new phone, why don't you try clearing out some storage, putting on a new case, and changing your wallpaper? See if that scratches the itch for novelty. See if you can refresh your phone. And everybody in that thread had tips on like how to make your phone last longer. And one of them is kind of on point. I feel, especially in the iOS camp, if you're feeling like your phone isn't as fresh as it used to be, go get it a new battery. Seriously. After you get a couple years out, Apple's penchant for putting in ridiculously small batteries really catches up with the iPhone fast. And it starts to run like poop. I'm really trying to keep this PG-13 at least for some reason. So I was kind of interested in this press release from T-Mobile saying that they're going to be adding in-store repairs. And I hope that this is really an initiative where they're going to be putting in actual hardware servicing equipment in the backs of their T-Mobile stores and not just, you drop it off at a T-Mobile store and then they have to send it off somewhere for some other kind of repair. I love the idea of more local, even if it's through a major carrier like T-Mobile. But they're going to be bumping up their insurance support. So accidental damage, loss and theft coverage, including next day business replacements, AppleCare for eligible Apple devices because you gotta, unlimited screen protector replacement. So no matter how many times your screen protector breaks, you can bring it in and just slap on a new one, which is kind of cool because at carriers, that's usually where you get fleeced for screen protectors. It was one of the Pixels that we got from my wife, and the only place, like, it was right at launch, we wanted her to try out a Pixel. She ended up not, like, I think it was the Pixel 2. And I think at the time, the only place we could find a decent screen protector was Verizon. And it was like a $40 screen protector that if we had been able to wait like 2 months, you could have gotten for like $8 for a three pack kind of a thing. So that's actually kind of cool. Not screen replacements, but unlimited screen protector replacements. Carriers make their margins by overcharging for those kinds of accessories. So that's actually kind of good if you're like my wife and she goes through many screen protectors over the course of owning one phone. I just want to highlight a few more of these. Hardware service coverages, such as mechanical breakdown, jump upgrades, and live tech support via the protection app. So all of this is coming to the improved the improved protection services. But on top of this, new in-store authorized repair locations. T-Mobile is upgrading 500 stores across the country to now include in-store device repairs by industry-certified experts from Assurant. I don't know how to say that company name. I've only ever read it. So, I feel like there's going to be, you know, some kind of conversation about, you know, third-party repair. Again, a Luis Rossman. I would be very curious to see what his thoughts on this might be. And especially, again, because T-Mobile has the leverage and the clout to kind of get Apple to play ball. So if T-Mobile is going to be able to sort of source parts and pieces, that could be kind of interesting or kind of disruptive. I believe what will happen is you're going to roll up to a T-Mobile with your busted Samsung and they're going to say, hey, you know what? We can swap the screen and the battery right here. It's going to take us 2 days because of, you know, the scheduling. Come on back. We'll have your phone all rebuilt for you. And I feel like the same person who comes in there with an iPhone 11, they're going to say, hey, you know what? That's great. Let's take a look at what we've got, parts and services, and then we'll ship it off to Apple for you. Or Apple will just verify, yes, that is an iPhone 11, give them a refurbed iPhone 11 and transfer their content over. I think that's going to be the extent of T-Mobile's ability to repair your gadget is going to be swapping it out for you. But I really do hope that they've got some actual lab equipment there and some actual hardware repair equipment there, because I genuinely hope we can really make these things last longer and not just turn them into immediate e-waste when they get damaged. This is just a quick story that, let me take another sip of water here.
Hey folks, are you getting bored of the current collection of tech and geek commentary on the internet? Is the discussion of new electronics feeling a bit stale? Do you want to find some fresh voices to add to your subscription queue? Check out the community on r glowing rectangles on Reddit. Now, this subreddit was built to help new voices in the tech community find more audience, and we need your support. Sharing, commenting, and those precious, tasty upvotes. Reddit can radically help a content creator expand their reach. Do you know a producer who deserves more attention? Do you just want to find fun new stuff? Head on over to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles and share or browse to your heart's content. Once again, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, and let's build something cool together.
Hold on, I want to say this from Streamy Boys. I tried to get a screen protector from Verizon for my mom's Moto One Ace 5G, and it was $40. Just went on blank. I think you just went online and got a pack of three glass ones for $8. Exactly. And again, if it hadn't, my wife is sort of notorious for treating her electronics in a direct and brutal fashion. Her purse is where all good phones go to die. If it hadn't been the situation that, like, she was gonna be using the phone that day, and we just needed to get something on it, and there genuinely was not something to buy online that we could get. Again, if it had been a month later, it would have been great. But literally, like, it was Pixel and Verizon, and that was the exclusivity, and it just was not happening. Everyone say hey to Barry Johnson, finally made the stream. What's up, Juan and chat? No worries for being late, buddy. You're not late. You're here right when you needed to be. All right, this is just a quick political news story. FTC signals a focus on non-competes and reporting loopholes after study of tech mergers. I'm going to have this one linked. This is coming by way of CNBC. Pretty good write-up. I would hope folks actually go hit this link, read through this reporting here, because it's something that I think we've all felt. But this is what's frustrating. Some of this stuff feels kind of obvious. The five major tech firms made 616 non-reportable transactions of more than $1 million between the beginning of 2010 and the end of 2019. 616. So all you need to do is value a company at under $92 million, and you don't need to go through the process of reporting this as any type of potentially consumer-harming or anti-competitive merger. And so there are also a number of these little loopholes where you can say, like, hey, this company is a subsidiary of this company, and this company is an umbrella under that company, and then this company, well, this company is only worth $5 million, but it's been piecemealed from what would have been a $100 million valuation. All of these little sort of nooks and crannies that you can kind of move through so that when a massive company like a Google, an Amazon, a Microsoft, an Apple, when they want something, they don't have to make a big stink out of acquiring a smaller developer to kind of pick up on what it is that they want here. FTC found 94 transactions were above the HSR threshold at the time that they were completed, likely due to a variety of possible reporting exemptions, according to staff. Well, we valued them at $90 million, and then once the merger was completed, magically, it was a $150 million company. Huh. So again, this kind of stuff, the FTC needed to spend years acquiring this data so that we could eventually get to the data point that this type of business practice likely creates monopolistic business practices which harm consumers. It takes so long for our underfunded government regulatory agencies to even build the information so that they know what they're talking about when they try to analyze how hyperfluid and fast this stuff really, really moves. All right. Moving right along. And case in point, we can take a look at a company like Apple. So Apple likes to acquire startups and kind of build their portfolio of developers and apps and services. And sometimes their timing just gets a little off, and maybe they couldn't make the offer they wanted to, or it was going to be too expensive. So then they can just block competition instead. And this is one I want us all to keep an eye on, because I think this might be an interesting lawsuit if it actually makes it to courts and Apple decides not to settle in private. So there's this little developer. They make a watch keyboard called FlickType. FlickType has been pulled from the App Store. I don't know if it's in here. Let me actually pull up the tweet. Hold on. So the developer, I can't pronounce that name, Costa Eleftheriou. I believe we've mentioned this developer before. Someone correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this was also one of the developers that brought up all of the scam apps on the Apple App Store. So they're not malware, but you go and you get like a really crappy keyboard add-on that then charges you the sneaky subscription to keep using it. And then they play a bunch of tricks with, you know, the ratings and the reviews to get bumped up. And then a legit, you know, a real keyboard app has a much harder time kind of breaking through. But this developer here for FlickType actually posted the rejection email from the Apple App Store. Specifically, the app is a keyboard app for Apple Watch. For this reason, your app will be removed from sale on the App Store at this time. We noticed your app does not satisfy the requirements outlined in the Apple iOS Human Interface Guidelines. Well, then Apple came out with their own version of it. So that, to me, would speak to a climate of anti-competitive behavior in the App Store. I don't know. It seems to be a data point worth investigating. So right now, just like developer confidence and developer sort of... What's the word I'm looking for? You know, the happiness index of developers doing business on the App Store seems to be at an all-time low. So I feel like we're going to be picking up a few more of these stories over the next several months and years. There definitely is something in the air speaking to some kind of, shift in how we relate to these massive organizations. Tech Potato, absolutely. This is, and it's not even just Amazon Basics. So Dr. Ian writes, Amazon does this with Amazon Basics, find what sells, then launch a cheaper version. And again, if you want to be on Amazon's platform, you pretty much have to give them all of your data. And then if they see that there's a business opportunity for them to compete more directly, they've got all the proprietary information they need to immediately launch a clone of your business. The one that really kind of broke my heart was Peak Design. Peak Design makes one of my all-time favorite camera slings, and the Amazon Basics clone is cheap garbage that looks very similar. And if you don't know what's up with camera bags, you might not be bothered by that. And oh, this other one's so much cheaper. And I was so happy when Peak Design called them out. So whenever we see this, this is a hugely anti-competitive style of business practice. And again, it speaks to the consumer detriment of overly relying on walled off gardens, closed off ecosystems. Apple, you know, just on their own, they saw that there was value in making a keyboard, a different kind of keyboard app for the Apple Watch. I mean, it was probably totally codependently arrived at the same idea, like coevolution, you know, like crabs. Let's change the subject and distract you with meaningless analogies. See, this is what I mean. And something tells me that someone at Apple crunched the numbers on this. So this is coming from Trey. Apple could have at least bought them out. Just shutting them down like that is the ultimate FU to their developers. They're the only reason they are the juggernaut that they are. And I'm sure there was someone in a suit with like a little old-timey, you know, tape-fed calculator. Nope, too expensive. And then so Apple just like, okay, well, we'll just knock them out. It's fine. No one will notice. It's a keyboard. From Blue Malicious, there's always a risk that Apple will decide to make their own app that takes up the functionality previously provided by a private app, but they shouldn't be able to just kick a private competitor out like that. And again, I feel like when we start talking about the operating system versus the individual services that run on an operating system, and then the relationship with third-party developers. I'm not praising Microsoft here because it's not like their hands are totally clean in this regard. But one of the reasons I feel, you know, we talk about like macOS versus Windows or iOS versus Microsoft tablets and things like that. And Windows feels a little less complete sometimes. It feels a little less nice out of the box. And I think it's just because they've been sued way more for things like including Internet Explorer in their operating system. And I feel like it's Apple's turn. It's Apple's turn to actually face more significant ire over those kinds of business practices. Dave Burns there. Oh, whoops. Did I get it? The comments are coming in so fast here. Their hands aren't clean. It's just different blood. Exactly, from Dr. Ian again. Technically, the clock is a service. It's all services, all the way down, an operating system on its own. Not particularly interesting. And exactly. So this is coming from Trey. And again, another very good point. I still feel like Apple's business model against, what are those geolocation tags? Apple's are AirTags. I've already forgotten the other name of the other company, but replying to Blue Malicious, Trey writes, that's the difference between this flick type and the location tags. This one, they actually shut the developers down. And even to that, you know, that degree, I feel like making something like AirTags and copying the business model of another company, even if it's not using one of exactly their patents or their trademarks, is kind of distasteful. Like, there's already a solution there. You could partner with them. I don't know where they draw the line, right? They're not bringing filmic style camera features to the Apple Camera app, and they feature Filmic heavily as a pro camera interface for the iPhone, so that's good. They're good with Filmic. But then why not partner with some other company to make kind of the better Apple ecosystem version of a service? Oh, Apple figured they could make more money just copying them and kicking them out. It's so funny that at some point those numbers have to tip over, and then Apple's gonna pounce. And this is a very good question, because I don't have a good answer. The best questions are the ones that I can't completely wrap my brain around. At what point does an app store become a public forum? And we talked about some of those other initiatives, politicians talking about making aspects of Google public domain and trying to like force a government break. Sort of a divestiture style split up of some of these larger companies. And it's tough. At some point, we're going to have some really tough conversations about the aspects of doing business with these mega corporations. Back in our country's history, we arrived at a conclusion for Mom, Pa, Bell. You know, we broke up the Bells. I don't know what that looks like for an Amazon, but it seems like Amazon is not doing a very good job of firewalling their different business divisions. So how do we fix that for them if there's no financial, you know, incentive for them to fix it themselves? Moving right along. Oh, that's the tweet. You know what? I'm actually going to kind of skip this story. In fact... The tech potato, Dr. Ian Cutress from Anantech. I'm going to say wait for coverage from Anantech and from Gary Explains before you come to any conclusions on the processing power of a new iPhone. They're going to do a better job of consistently testing based on how they've consistently tested in the past. And right now we're in this firestorm of speculation. But in this firestorm, I'm still going to link to this article from semianalysis.com. And it's a pretty broad write-up on some of the background happenings at Apple, some of the engineers that they've lost in their semiconductor team going to other companies. And it's an interesting read, and it's a little too dense for me to well sum up. But it's talking about The title of the article, sorry, and if you want to look this up before, you know, the show notes are published, Apple CPU gains grind to a halt and the future looks dim as the impact from the CPU engineer exodus to Nuvia and Rivo starts to bleed in. For all of Apple's unlabeled benchmark claims, I've never found the real-world app-based performance of an iPhone to be so substantially better than the competition that that would make a purchasing decision for me. And this is a pretty heady write-up of analyzing Apple's own claims, looking at the history of previous A-series processors based on those old claims, and then looking at the business implications of who has left the company. So I'm going to let their writing do the talking for themselves, but please go catch it out. Semianalysis.com. Apple CPU gains grind to a halt. That should take you right to the article if you just want to search directly off of that. When we actually test this stuff real world, like for example, for me, the one that hurt the most was how much time and energy I invested because I was really stoked to go Apple XS. If you've ever gone back to watch some of my archive of videos, I've always preferred the S series phones. The new model number comes out, and it looks prettier, or it looks different. But the S series fixes all of the problems that plagued the previous phone. iPhone 4, antenna issues. iPhone 4S, much better. iPhone 5 had battery issues and some type of screen problem, if I remember correctly, and then also had like rattling buttons. iPhone 5S, way better, all the way through the iPhone SE. The continued evolution of the iPhone 5, amazing. The iPhone 5 itself, not as good. iPhone 6, bend gate, touch disease, flex damage. Those issues with the iPhone 6 persisted all the way through to the iPhone SE 2020, with the exception of the frame not just bending like Play-Doh. Apple, time and time again, every time the form factor changes, that phone not as good as the S series variant that fixes all those issues. iPhone 12, first phone with 5G, battery life garbage. iPhone 13, which is kind of an iPhone 12S, bigger batteries. Apple has no problems turning you into a beta tester when you get the prettier new form factor. So again, when we really break this stuff down, and especially when we talk about performance numbers, like I was seeing on the iPhone XS that like iPhone 6S's were just as performant. I don't think that's a word. We're just as powerful and just as fast as the newest iPhone XS in doing complex like video rendering tests. And to the point where also like old LGs were able to hang with the newest, most bleeding edgiest iPhone XS's. Going from like the XS to the 11, Apple was talking up, you know, like 15% performance improvements, 20% GPU improvements. And then Gary explains was like, nah, I mean, with what we can really use, with what you can really do on an iPhone, the delta is like 5%. Why would you buy that? Why would you flip it? Oh, it's so much more powerful. Where can you use it? It's 60% more powerful than the competition. How? Where? Just show me where it is 60% more powerful. Anything. And Apple won't do it. So when articles like this come out, I know it's clickbaity and I know it's kind of just leaning into the fervor, but it's worth giving that a read because I think they've done a very good job of laying out the timeline on how these behind-the-scenes business moves have actually affected positive change, and now we're seeing potentially the negative change of some of these business and organization shakeups. I'm going to breeze through these next two stories just because they're more leaky and rumory, and the Microsoft event is coming up in a couple days, and I still need to decide if I'm going to dedicate part of my meager review budget towards picking up a Duo 2 because it's one of the phones I'm so like Pixel 6, I'm most anxiously excited for. Duo 2, I'm most anxiously concerned 4. And the Duo 2 just showed up at the FCC, and they're confirming some kind of wireless power transfer, but it might not be Qi charging, but it should be arriving with a Snapdragon 888 and with more cameras and with proper 5G. NFC is supposed to be making an appearance here. So some interesting hardware upgrades, but I'm still... It's this image right here. If there's a trio of cameras on the back of the Duo, I do not want a domino bulge sticking out the back of a Duo. The best thing about the Duo's form factor as a pocketable tablet is that it folds all the way shut. I cannot get enough of how sleek, how holdable such a large device is. It makes the iPhone mini look like antiquated design. Barry, exactly, same thing. Duo, I am concerned as well. I am anxiously excited for Pixel 6. I'm kind of breathing through my teeth a little bit for Duo 2. So all of these things kind of line up. I would have preferred a Duo 2 talking Snapdragon 870. Better power management. We know they're not going to be able to cram the biggest batteries into these ultra-thin panels on the Duo. So many parts of this are making me concerned for it. Trying to be a better phone is going to make it a poorer tablet. And I like that the Duo is one of the best Android tablets I've ever used, and it's an okay phone. I mean, again, I want that nuance, and I want that separation between different products and different services. So that's the first Duo FCC. We know there's some kind of Duo 2 in testing, and maybe hopefully this will spur Microsoft to eventually give us an operating system update on the Duo 1. The other one is kind of in the same ballpark. Now moving properly over into a more Windows-powered device, Microsoft Surface Pro 8 might include a 120Hz screen and Thunderbolt ports. So Thunderbolt 4 would be a nice upgrade for the pros. I don't think Microsoft was wrong, but I always did find it a little disappointing that Surfaces lacked Thunderbolt 3 ports. And to Microsoft's credit, we did eventually discover that there was a potentially upsetting security exploit found in Thunderbolt 3. And I believe Microsoft really does consider the corporate market one of their top, you know, sort of industries. Even my wife's work-issued laptop is a Surface. So I don't think they're wrong. But it was disappointing, or at least not having some kind of way around the potential exploit that was found with Thunderbolt 3. But, you know, if we can put all these parts together... Well, first of all, we can speculate if it's Thunderbolt, it's going to be Intel, probably not an AMD-powered machine. I think it's more, what does 120Hz bring to a Windows-powered machine, which is going to be ultra-slim and sleek, and I'm sure it's going to get good-ish battery life, but it's not going to be known for being like the longest-lasting road warrior battery champ like an M1-powered MacBook. You know, again, ARM really working wonders for Apple's power management and battery longevity. So when we put all those things together, I'm just kind of curious, like, what does 120Hz give us if it's just like a slightly more fluid start button, right? So I'm kind of struggling a bit on one of my favorite lines of mixed mode computers. Like, Surface helped us redefine what like a convertible tablet should be like. And it's incredible. Do I still have it on my desk? It's folded up in the back. I still have like a Surface RT, you know, like just this idea. I've got museum pieces. I love this concept. I don't know that 120Hz brings much to this kind of desktop computing. And I really don't think this is the kind of hardware that's going to handle any kind of 120Hz or 120 frame per second gaming. I mean, unless it's like really, really, really old pixel arty games that aren't really going to be played anymore. So I don't know how to feel about that. Oh man, there's like a lot of conversation going on about the Duo. Oh, from Russ. Yeah, it would be nice if we could see a little bit more AMD flavor getting that Thunderbolt support up. I mean, again, there are some ways on some motherboards that we'll see some Thunderbolt come to AMD powered desktops. I don't know. I mean, I feel like, or maybe if Dr. Ian can weigh in on something like this, it's, I don't think it likely in the near term for portables. And I don't know why that separation is in my brain. If Thunderbolt 4 is going to be a bit more of an Intel exclusive for the sort of the initial combination launch of next generation Intel chipsets, Intel based motherboards, Intel peripherals, Windows 11, and Windows 11 bringing better support for different CPU cores. I forget what that's called. When you've got big little combinations of CPU cores and the next generation of Intel processors are going to be kind of leaning into that sort of CPU design for mobile equipment. So yeah. Oh, and he would jump right on it. Okay, Intel has Thunderbolt 4 built into the CPU. Everyone else needs a controller that takes power and costs money. Okay, so that makes perfect sense to me. The additional costs, the additional space, the additional prices. If I'm building an AMD desktop, I'm good spending more to get a Thunderbolt controller and taking up one of my PCI slots to get it, making an ultra slim Surface tablet-y kind of thing. I can understand why someone leaning AMD would probably not want to dedicate the cost and the space and the power to making something like that happen. Thank you. I knew he would be able to sum it up and just tell it like it is. He's a straight shooter. Real good at the podcasting. And these are the last stories here, just kind of taking us through all of the news block. I mean, think about this. I just did like news and gadget block and housekeeping and everything, and we're only at 1 hour. Come on. This is like the most efficient podcast I've ever put together. Excuse me. Sorry, I know I've got my mic really close here, and I just like... just totally coughed into the mic there. All right. Lastly, this is a kind of a big deal story, and I'm really happy to see it. This sounds cynical, but it's something I've been wanting OnePlus to do since the OnePlus 7. I've been desperate for OnePlus to focus on different product lines and not keep shotgunning the same phone over and over and over again with only meager differences in design. And so when the news broke, and I caught it early this morning, this is coming by way of XDA, written up by Kishan. OnePlus confirms it has canceled the OnePlus 9T. And I could not be happier. The OnePlus 9 is a baller phone. The OnePlus 9 Pro is a phenomenal, competitive, premium tier device. Support those two, deliver the software you need. We know they're going to be combining, merging their various operating system branches. So sort of the more Chinese flavor of Android versus the more Western flavor of Android. They're just going to be pooling all of that developer effort and just streamlining moving forward. And when we have other products that need to be addressed, we've got a new line of phones like the Nord that can address more, you know, mid-pack, mid-range, and lower entry-level devices. I am so happy. I don't want to speak ill because I really enjoyed my time with the Black Shark and the Mi 11i. But really, what are you getting on a Xiaomi 11T? I feel like this need to have a second half of the year polish of the phone that you launched earlier in the year often doesn't really accomplish what you hope it will. It kind of divides up your consumer market. Those little changes really do bring additional complications in long-term software and operating system, security patching, developer support. It's a lot of money to also market and advertise. And here we've got one story. We put out the OnePlus 9. We put out the OnePlus 9 Pro. We're bringing new features to those phones, which we're going to talk about in just a sec here too. And those are the phones. We're done. Now, in the second half of the year, we can kind of refresh on Nords and N200s and all these other things. Maybe there's a little bit more room in the marketing budget to talk about accessories. The OnePlus Buds look pretty good. You have less to manage, less to support, and there's a more of a commitment. It doesn't feel like your OnePlus 9 is immediately less valuable resale. Like, it's not like you're going to flip a OnePlus 9 to a OnePlus 9T, but if you wanted to sell your OnePlus 9 next year, it's not worth as much as a 9T. The 9T is the newer phone. It's better. Okay, cool, I guess. I really don't like that kind of launch strategy. I much better prefer launching different segments of devices and different tiers, like pricing tiers of devices at different times throughout the year. And you can keep an organic conversation going with your customers throughout the entire year. And increasingly we've seen, like, it doesn't matter, like, oh, this is the first phone to get the 888. No one cares. No one cares. It is irrelevant. You launch an 888 in the middle of the year, you're fine. You're fine. If you're launching it with unique features that cater to a specific consumer demographic, those are the consumers going to go for it. You're good. All right? It's only in the tech enthusiasm sphere that anyone would care about, like, who got the most powerful Qualcomm, the fastest, and the cheapest. I'm not going to pay $1,000 for a phone. You can get the same processor in a 1970s Yugo. Like, no one cares. So anyway, this to me was the good move. I'm really happy to see OnePlus just taking a step back. You know, they've got a lot on their plates. They're merging their operating systems. They're supporting a wider portfolio of devices. They're integrating more directly into BBK and becoming more of a sort of a partner brand for Oppo. Do it right and take the time and don't launch sort of a half-baked refresh of the OnePlus 9 when the OnePlus 9 is still a perfectly competitive phone against the current crop of devices out there. You know, put some of this marketing budget just towards kind of freshening up the image of the OnePlus 9, and I think everyone's going to be fine. It's good. Let's scroll back up. Oh, and Basic Jose, that is true. There are plans. They can release OnePlus 9R outside of India. So I believe there is going to be a T variant of the OnePlus 9R. And I'm not sure if OnePlus really has any designs or plans on bringing the R series anywhere else. Like, it feels so specifically built for one region. It's OnePlus 9 region, you know, like the one region where that phone is really built for. And from Fat Produce, I'm interested to see how Color OS evolves over the next couple of years. And again, these OS skins, I have never been a big fan of MIUI. MIUI 12 is surprisingly good. It's not my favorite flavor of this juicy, bright, vibrant, entertaining interface for a computing device. I still prefer the stark utilitarian design of an Xperia. But I can't find the big gotcha. It's not like TouchWiz back in the day where it tanked phone performance for trying to be prettier. It's good. And I feel like I haven't had any recent experiences with Color OS. I kind of feel it's probably going to be the same way. Hey, TK is in the chat. Everyone say, hey, TK, because it kind of rhymes. So from Michael from a Corcoran 3, yeah, if you launch an 888 in January of 2022, old hardware. When we get to the beginning of 2022, when we get to January of next year, I still believe Snapdragon 865s and 870s are probably still going to be leading the way for the most consistent performance of most of our consumer software. Phones that operated at kind of the peak of the premium SoCs, like peak CPU and GPU power didn't need to be throttled nearly as aggressively, handled higher thermals much more gracefully. I'll be very curious to see if next generation SoCs are able to improve upon the efficiency of the 888. I don't believe we need more power. We need power that can be more consistently applied. And an 865 does that better currently. 888 is more powerful, can be demonstrated, is a nice perk for a certain collection of apps you might run from your phone, is not an across-the-board upgrade year over year.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people, producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
Hey, what's going on, Juan, and all of you tuned in to today's show. I'm Nick Gray from Fandroid. I've known Juan for quite a few years now, and you may have actually heard my voice from back in the day when Juan used to host the Pocket Now Weekly. If you're not familiar with Fandroid, we were actually the very first Android news site to hit the web, publishing our very first article within hours of Google making their announcement about their mobile operating system. Of course, a lot has changed since then, but we're still here covering the news, reviewing new gadgets, and of course, sharing our passion for Android with anyone who wants to join in. You can find all of our work on Fandroid.com. That's Phandroid.com. But if you love video, and I'm sure you do since you're listening to Juan's podcast, be sure to check us out at youtube.com/Fandroid as well. And that's going to do it. Juan, thanks for featuring us. Back to you.
Oh, good. Everyone is saying hey to TK. That made me happy. So the other thing that I just wanted to bring up, and then we can get just sort of proper into the Q&A, OnePlus brought some new features. This is the kind of stuff I love to see. We were talking about Android updates. You know, hey, you know, you want new Android features. They're going to be coming directly to Android phones. And OnePlus brought a new camera feature to their phones, and it's kind of fun to use. So if anyone is familiar with X-Pan photography from Hasselblad cameras, it's this very bold kind of elongated film frame. I have a hard time sort of describing it because I'm not as familiar with Hasselblad film back cameras. I was a Mamiya shooter. Snop snob. But there's this idea of leaning into the roots of photography to play with sort of bygone eras of film photography. And bringing those tools to, or bringing those kinds of features or that kind of characteristic to digital photography is a really interesting idea. So X-Pan has arrived. It is a way to create an almost panoramic style, ultra long strip of photography. And I think it's interesting. This is a fun feature. This is just like any other filter on any other phone. It's not necessarily the idea that you are meant to incorporate this into some kind of workflow or rely on it as like a way to replace, you know, some other aspect of mobile photography. It's just, you could do something else with your camera. And yeah, there's a way that you can just crop most of your shots, but OnePlus is doing something a little bit different with this that could potentially bring some benefits. One of the major, I've got my OnePlus over here. So one of the major criticisms of this X-Pan feature, it's a really long kind of cinema-wide crop. Right? So why can't you just take a regular photo from the HDR version and just do, because you can do on a OnePlus camera where it fits the screen width. And isn't that just exactly the same thing? Well, no. They are changing up color processing. There is a black and white filter of it. It immediately can toggle between the ultra wide and the main camera sensor. And then it spits out a much higher resolution final JPEG. It's a 20 megapixel bin as opposed to a 12 megapixel bin, which when you crop from a 12 megapixel bin is a lot lower resolution. So it's fun. That's all it's really supposed to be. And OnePlus and their cameras suck. And like, if anyone struggles to get good shots out of a OnePlus, you have to be phenomenally bad at photography. I mean, like, you have to be utterly incompetent at pointing a camera sensor at something and pushing a button what captures the photo. I'm never going to make the argument that OnePlus cameras are to bestest, because I genuinely don't believe any smartphone camera is. But I've really been excited to see OnePlus kind of craft their own unique feel for a camera. If you don't like that feel, that's fine. But to try and claim that there's some objective detriment to shooting on a OnePlus speaks more about you than it does the camera. So I actually took a couple sample shots. Let me take another drink of water here. Aditya nailed it. I got to drink and stretch. Ooh, that was a gross neck crap. I hope that really made it onto the mic here. All right. So here's also an interesting test. Please, anyone tell me if they can hear the weed whackers that are immediately outside my window right now. If anyone, I'm dying to hear if the NVIDIA broadcast software that I'm running right now is really doing its job. So I took a couple photos. Here's one of the funny things. OBS has a photo plugin. It does not work. If I put more than three photos into a slideshow, it just craps out. It's so annoying. So I'm going to be going through my web browser to show this stuff off. So just to kind of highlight some of these photos here. So this is just a simple bookshelf shot. And you know, when you double click in Firefox, it does like a hard like 100% zoom in, right? So I'm going to line up with my Darth Vader Pez dispenser. And that's the operating resolution that we're working at. When you start moving this up to like a 20 megapixel final bin, it's a different photo than what you would have gotten out of the normal auto HDR. So and I can show this here. So this is the X-Pan crop in color for my Soundwave shelf. You can kind of see just how long and skinny that is. And now here's essentially the cinema wide crop from the auto HDR. And it's just a little bit taller. Again, it is a different aspect of how they're trying to organize, crop, and deliver a different kind of image. But full zoom on my little cassette tape Decepticons. This is terrible podcasting, by the way, for anyone listening to the audio version of this. Unfortunately, you're just going to have to deal with a couple mouse clicks and me describing the photos to you. You might want to kick over to the video version of the podcast for this. But your ability to just reframe quickly, set your shot, and arrive at a bolder representation of an image is kind of fun. And I love it. You know, what this really feels like to me is of a successful version of some of the black and white style filters we used to get on Huawei phones. You know, Huawei, especially back in their dual camera sensor days, there was a color sensor and a Luma sensor, just a black and white image sensor just for light and image data. And when you took a black and white photo, it wasn't just desaturated from the main sensor. Huawei would actually move you over to the dedicated black and white camera sensor. It is a different way of handling, processing, and working with light. And obviously, they're not doing this on the OnePlus. They're not using the 2 megapixel, black and white sensor for low light video. They are using the main camera sensor here, but the feel of the photos that come off of X-Pan feel a little like those classic multi-camera Huawei joints. Massive goes, hey, you jerk. But Juan, monochrome sensors don't do anything. Who would even take a 2 megapixel black and white photo? Why would you even waste it? Oh, I don't understand how tech works. I'm a tech reviewer. Moving right along. So this is just sort of a neighborhood shot. It's a nice little home. It looks really great in black and white. Flipping it over into color. I like what OnePlus does with kind of the slightly more contrasty look. this feels appropriately aged. The only thing that bugs me about this photo is I should have framed at the sidewalk so that I didn't cut off the top of the tree on the right-hand side. It's not as good a photo or a light manipulation for closer-up photos. Just like other panoramas, I would recommend using this for wider shots, for more dramatic, bold kinds of images. This doesn't really do it for me as a macro. You know, even though this is a really bold representation of a rose, when we look at the color processing on the color version of it, I don't love that. And it could maybe be better with a simpler background, but you know, some of this color and image processing gets a little hyped and saturated for that film look that they're going for. I don't know. It's just not my flavor. But then you just do something simple. Baseball field with sprinklers on. And this just looks like that scene. I'm not a good landscape photographer. I'm a macro photographer. My zen is rolling around in the dirt trying to get close-up photos of flowers and bugs. This made my totally mundane framing of a baseball field look so much better. This one I actually am going to credit to the camera and not the photographer, but when I take the time to try and arrive at an interesting shot, like, I dig that. Shooting, you know, sort of hard side lit, a little bridge over a wooded area on a hiking trail. I'm kneeling into the dirt to kind of get a lower angle shot. It's a bit more dramatic. The black and white makes it just sort of a bit more dramatic. And I think that kind of works. Shooting into the sun. You know, so the sun is sort of centered. And you can see the shadows are all coming towards my camera. And this is a stupid shot of the hiking trail near my home. Looks so good. I love the vibe on that. And it's just really stupid, simple software. I thought the tree came out just a touch too bright. I wanted it a little darker, a little crunchier. So on this palm tree, there's a little slider, and I dropped the exposure a third of a stop, and that's what I like. Now, this would normally be sort of a hyper-saturated blue sky. I don't love the color as much, but it's handled it well. It's contrastier. It's got a, kind of a darker edge to it. And same thing. You know, playing with a sign that's kind of backlit, this image sensor is able to resolve a wonderful look at, and especially when it's not taxed with color information, it's a wonderful look at kind of an old part of our neighborhood, it's literally old Agora, with the sun coming behind the sign. You can see the shadows are very dramatically landing in front of the sign, and yet, like, even the worn old detail in the wood is still preserved. The only thing I don't like about X-Pan for it being a higher resolution image is I think their noise reduction is just a touch too aggressive. So, like, on that sign, when you're blowing up that image, some of that fine wood detail is a bit smeared because it's so aggressively pulling the noise. And actually, if you're doing X-Pan, that would be the best time to lean into grain, make it look a little bit more like film grain as opposed to trying to make everything as sort of beautifully clean as it can. That's my only complaint. So again, it's a fun feature. That's it. I can't tell you like how obnoxious it is. Like, there was a OnePlus headline that a new feature came to the camera inspired by old school Hasselblad cameras, and it was the same knee-jerk, patting themselves on the back for being so clever. OnePlus cameras suck so hard. And you're like, you're missing it. What sucks is, like, I shot a whole morning just in X-Pan, and I had a blast. I had fun. Is that really going to be the feature I'm going to use to, like, try and capture my daughter's soccer practice? No. But did this just make me a bit more interested in doing some more landscape photography? Because I don't like landscape photography, but I liked this. This was a fun challenge to reframe scenes and to walk around my neighborhood and try and find angles. And, like, I'm not good at that. I suck at that. So this made me more interested in trying it. And isn't that the whole point of bringing a new feature to a phone camera? Is that you should try to do something new with it. You should try to do something else with it. So, yeah, I'm happy with it. And I hope other people, especially the people who actually bought the phone and not the people who just talk about the phone, give it a whirl, because it is a really interesting take on reframing how you normally compose your shots. And I have to take a quick break here. Al Sabakli just dropped a bunch of tier one subs for Erguys, Russ9123, Slivikic, JJ4884, and Pacostin. Thank you so much, Al. That is awesome of you for supporting the production on this series, on this podcast. I was in the middle of looking through all my photos and trying to sound articulate and when it comes to photography, and I missed the little stretch of subs there. So thank you so much. Always greatly appreciate supporting the support on this stream. Gary the Fireman, I know. See, again, this is one of the things Gary writes. Wait till you see my photos on my Pixel 6 Pro. I am very anxiously excited about the Pixel. You know, Google's first step up to a larger camera sensor. Google is still, I don't care what you say, when it comes to not only just the image processing, but the image capture, Google's auto mode is a step ahead. I do not like the new iOS camera app. I think it's cluttered. I think it makes you look for things in ways that distract from composition. And from like the Pixel 4a on, Google has increasingly brought more functionality to their camera app while making the camera app even easier to use. And that is a humongously difficult software engineering challenge. And I think they have delivered the best flavor of this. If you want the manual modes, you go with the Sony. If you want the sort of multitude of fun modes with slightly better integration for other third-party camera apps, you go with the Samsung. You want the biggest camera sensors, you go with a Samsung or a Xiaomi. But when it comes to pick up phone, point camera at something, push shutter button, get pretty photo, I think the Pixel has nailed it. So I'm anxious to see what happens to a Pixel when it's called a Pro and it's got a larger image sensor that has not been as well trained. You know, the 12 megapixel sensor that's on a Pixel is a little bit smaller, but Google's training algorithms are phenomenally well refined by this point. So switching up the sensor does actually introduce a number of other challenges for training good photo processing software. Fat Produce is in there talking about landscape photography. I am awful. I do not. So when I see a really pretty landscape photo, I can see what makes that photo interesting. I live in gorgeous scenery. I live in, you know, the hills. There are mountains and beautiful sunsets, and I cannot frame. Like, I functionally cannot make my brain look at a beautiful sunset and say, "This is the layering and the composition and what I should be focusing on to make this sunset really pop." I occasionally accidentally land on something, and I think some of my X-Pan photos are pretty good, but I am not proficient at that. I don't know what it is, but if you show me a dandelion growing out of the dirt next to a sidewalk, I can drop to my stomach, take a couple quick pics, roll back off, and then say, "Hey, look, this is the coolest photo of a dandelion you'll see today." I like taking things apart anyway, and macro photography for me kind of feels like a dissection that never harms the thing that I'm dissecting. I don't know, I mean, that's a gross way of putting it, but like I can see all of the individual pieces and parts and the things that you never consider. Like when you're a grown up and you're just looking down on a flower and you see flower, but when I'm looking at it through the lens of a macro photo, I'm looking at every tiny little detail and structure. And that to me is an interesting celebration of all of the parts becoming the whole. And that's a story. Like I can almost tell that story if I'm taking a photo of an insect or if I'm taking a photo of a flower or something. Landscape? Nope. Too big. My brain can't handle it. So, what are we at? We're at 10:30. We got a half hour. I made it through all of the news stories and did like a little feature highlight on X-Pan. I'm stopping the podcast just to sit here and say, hey, I'm proud of me. I'm going to kind of just take another little stretch. And what do we want to talk about? I mean, obviously Pixel 6 is going to keep popping up, but specifically if we want to chat Pixel 6, I feel like so much of it has been kind of nitpicked and talked to death until it's legit in people's hands. The little New York showcase is kind of cool. I love to see Google actually putting some more marketing dollars behind their product. I'm laughing at all the other tech reviewers that are acting, oh, Google's hyping. Like, we're so used to only Samsung being allowed to advertise that now Google doing the bare minimum to talk about their product. Does Google deserve to hype their products? You don't even know if the phone's going to be good yet, and they're hyping their products. By the way, let's go off the rails for Galaxy S22 rumors now that we've already talked the Fold and the Flip to death. Like, we've already plunged into the death of Fold and Flip coverage being, you know, highlighted on YouTube. Now we need our next fix for Samsung rumors. Let's see. Dave Burns, this is the best one has ever done for time. Yeah, I'm pretty great. From Russ9123, speaking of macro, would Pixel 6 series have one? So here's the deal. Apple made a big deal about wide-angle macro shots on the iPhone 13. There is a benefit to that. I'm not saying that this isn't a feature because I love macro photography. This is a cool feature to have. I feel if you have a good pixel binning main camera sensor, you deal with less barrel and optical distortion. You will likely have better light performance, like especially if lighting is not amazing on that subject. If you go to a 2x zoom on your main camera sensor, you can often arrive at what I feel is a better looking macro shot than what a wide angle can achieve. So if the Pixel 6 wide angle camera sensor does not somehow magically fulfill the same kind of performance as the OnePlus 9, because right now the OnePlus 9 is the phone to beat for wide angle. I don't care what you say. The humongous image sensor that's on the back of this phone camera for both the main sensor and the ultra-wide. The ultra-wide sensor on the OnePlus 9 is larger than the main camera sensor on the iPhone 13. I mean, like, if we're talking about larger sensors as some sort of advantage for the aesthetics of photography, it's there. You just got to reach out and grab it. I want to see, oh, I don't know if I still have it up. Let me see if on my Discord, because I think I got rid of the actual photos. I shared them and then I deleted them. It might still be here on the photography. Give me a second. I'm going to scroll. So I was talking to, was it Gary or Paul? And we were talking about this very thing. I've got a whole bunch of X-Pan photos up there. It might take me a second to scroll through. So this was one of, here, let me share this. This was one of my macro photos from, this was from the OnePlus 9 Pro with a 2x zoom. So this just gets you right on top of your subject. You've got like that nice shallow depth of field. The shell, this is a little snail shell where the tip is in focus and just to the edges of the shell, it's already starting to blur away. But I had another, yeah, here. So this is from the wide angle and from as near the same position as I could match. You can see how even center punched, but just because my little Godzuki, or baby Zilla, this is a baby Zilla, not a Godzuki. My little baby Zilla is nearing the edge of the frame here. There's this optical distortion at the top of this frame. If I had been better able to keep the face just a little bit lower in the frame, it wouldn't be as pronounced. But then if I take a 2x zoom, it's way better in proportion. You know, you see there's way less of this distortion kind of stretching the face out. The background blur is nicer. The bokeh is nicer. And this main sensor does a better job of handling some of the backlit shadow on the main body and the main face. This is a lot darker and contrastier from the ultra-wide, and the ultra-wide is working with a smaller aperture. So it's actually doing a poorer job of soaking up as much light as the main sensor. When we look at examples like that, I'm not going to be heartbroken if Pixel 6 can't pull off the same macro photography trick if that 50 megapixel GN1 can give us a better pixel resample as you zoom in. Having more of those dots to play with, Google should have a really good handle on the demosaicing of these pixel binning sensors. That to me is probably going to be the bigger perk if we're talking about macro photography. Dave Ferns, that's a good question. I haven't been up to date on Lenovo in a while. The Moto Ace is the last Moto I've used in quite a bit, and I'm still trying to get my hands on something with Ready 4. But a Lenovo Android tablet with Ready 4 would definitely be more interesting, kind of a nicer way to kind of move up my list. I would love to see if that kind of functionality can be added to like a dock. You know, like I take my YouPerfect or my Next dock, plug it into a tablet with Ready 4. I think the only thing that gives me a little pause with Lenovo tablets is they always come out with these incredible features, really fun hardware. Sometimes it's a projector, crazy long batteries, but then they'll just like, okay, well, all you need for a processor is a Snapdragon 400. And that kills me. I want to see a balls-to-the-wall Lenovo premium-tier tablet. I just feel like that would be epic. And then you add in something like Ready 4 where you can change up the UI, kind of like Samsung and DeX, would make me so happy. From Blue Malicious, definitely try and make this happen if you can. So Blue Malicious writes, I had the opportunity. Oh, you did. You already did it. I had the opportunity to see an Xperia Pro, Xperia 1 Mark III, and Xperia 5 Mark III IRL over the weekend. Sony had a stand at a photography trade show with them on. Let me know what you think. I thought it was going to arrive last week. I got a bunch of shipping notifications on a whole bunch of review gear that's coming in. And somewhere along the way, I completely forgot to follow up on my 1 Mark III. And so it's not here now. But I'm hoping that it will arrive in the next couple days. Because I realized my channel took a bigger hit than what I thought it was going to handle. With no LG in the game, I did not realize how often I formulated my like comparison videos. Like I don't do a lot of comparison videos anymore, but they were pretty heavily focused on what I was most familiar using. And without an LG phone this year, a number of those kind of off the cuff, hey, let me just chat out my experiences using the Xiaomi against this LG. That couldn't happen this year. And so the Xperia 1 is going to end up being one of my main comparison points against Pixel 6. I'm still hoping really hard that I can get, say, a Vivo. You know, I'm talking to their PR. I don't know if anything's going to happen. I really want to play with an X70 and see what they can do for gimbal photography. And this is funny, but one of the first videos I want to showcase is a Vivo against an LG Wing. You know, like the two phones that actually bothered to include, I mean, there have been others, but two of the phones that actually bothered to include this kind of radical image stabilization. And because I always think it's hilarious, like you see someone pick up an LG Wing and they're like, okay, so if I walk really carefully and I keep the phone as stable as possible, look how amazing this gimbal footage is. It's so smooth. You can do that now. Go get, starting with the LG G8. LGs have had software stabilization for 4K video at 60 frames per second. And then moving forward, even Samsung's are hit and miss, but get up to like an S20 and you've got 4K 60 software stabilization. If you just tuck your elbows and you loosen the grip on the phone so that your hands aren't like trying to death grip it, if you walk and roll your steps, your normal video stabilization is going to look incredible. On a OnePlus 9 Pro, if I just relax my hands and I tuck my my elbows into my ribs, it looks like I'm on a tripod. It's phenomenal. So a gimbal doesn't help you with that. A gimbal helps you when you are actively skipping with a 5-year-old and trying to match your camera skips to her skips so that you can kind of bend the world around you but keep her in the middle of the frame. That looks like garbage on a OnePlus 9. That looks incredible on an LG Wing. So that's where a gimbal really helps you. That was a really long ramble on Blue Malicious's comment there. But I'm realizing now, like, I'm going to be getting into the end of this year, and I've just kind of got like a backlog of comparison ideas that have all gone unshot because I didn't get an LG V70. I didn't get a Velvet 2. One of the cornerstone phones that I relied on for coverage vanished, and I didn't really know how to compensate for that. So getting back into camera reviews, getting back into audio reviews, getting back into comparison videos, like, I've got a lot of catching up to do, and I'm going to be leaning on the Xperia 1 for that, I guess. So we'll see. Yeah, Gabaletta as a comment on Google advertising. We're used to Samsung bombarding us with ads. It has become the norm. Kind of like the majority of ads we see on TV, most people just get used to it. And Barry, completely agree here too. I don't understand the sentiment. Let's wait until the Pixel 6 to arrive before we get excited. It makes zero sense. See, the thing is, and Dustadori, Pixel 6 will be too expensive. It's not worth it because it should do way more than a Galaxy and only be half the price. I'm good at tech. Except that you're not. I like building the anticipation. I like building the excitement before the reveal. I hate leaks and rumors, and I talk about them on this podcast, but I really don't like how that sucks some of the fun out of the discovery. You know, like, I don't feel any need to cover an iPhone 13 because Apple just went and did a whole product overview. What are the first videos that come out on the iPhone? Let's tour the new iPhone 13 features. Already out there. Apple already did it. It's done. That topic on YouTube is done. So I really like this strategy from Google. I like building some anticipation. I like getting anxious. I like getting excited for a new product launch. I've got high expectations. I'm trying to keep them in check. But this is the most exciting phone launch of the year for me, is seeing what Google can do with a new camera sensor and their own custom SoC. And it's the only opportunity we have for some real competition, especially in North America, because I'm so tired of the only conversation in the United States that ever seems to break through the YouTube algorithm being Samsung versus Apple, Apple versus Samsung. What about Sam Apple? What about Apple Sung? You know, like, this is dull. You want to talk about phones dying? It's because we've got two companies that are radically trying to be like each other, and we don't have another competitive point. So I'm stoked. Google, I know I'm lining up with another like trillion-dollar corporation here, but give me something. Give me something to talk about, because I don't think the only avenue for fun phone conversations is novelty. I believe there is plenty of conversation left in productivity, in content creation, in gaming, in high performance, in better battery life, better data management, in radios. There are still plenty of things for us enthusiasts to get excited about and share that excitement with the so-called normies who don't watch videos like mine. Take my video content and go talk to your family and friends and get them excited about what they can do on their phones. I will love you for that. And Barry Johnson, absolutely correct. Best wide angle, absolutely OnePlus 9. So from Pakistan, we've had the low light craze. What happened there? Why is it stagnating? Ultra wide, now macro. What is the next must have feature for next year? That's a very good question. I think the marketing is going to lean heavy. Oh, I'm sorry, I can leave your comment up. I think the marketing is going to lean heavy into dopey megapixel wars. I think we're going to see 48, 50, 108 megapixels. It's all meaningless data. It's just as meaningless as Apple putting out an unlabeled bar graph or a big, not even a bar graph, just 60% better than another device that we're not going to tell you what it is. Like, that is insultingly useless information. And megapixels, free of any other context, equally useless. When it comes to actually useful features, though, I hope we'll see a continuation of what Sony and OnePlus have done for slow motion. Video shot 4K at 120 frames per second it's an incredible upgrade for a fun novelty feature. Slow motion video is a novelty, and the novelty dies really fast if the video quality can't hang with at least 1080p normal video. And so when you fire up these 480 frame per second, 1,000 frame per second slow motion burst modes, but then you go and you look at the footage and it's grainy and it's blocky and it's pixelated, it's low-fi image capture, but really, really fast, that novelty evaporates. You use it once, you shrug, you go, hey, that's kind of neat, and then you'll probably never use it again. I don't know a lot of people really messing with slow motion video these days because the 1080p video capture is so much better. So when you pick up a Sony, Xperia 1, Xperia 5 Mark II, Xperia 1 and 5 Mark III, and you frame a slow motion video shot in 4K, and it's only 1/4 slowdown, right? It's a 4-to-1 drop. To go from 120 to 30 frames per second. I mean, you can kind of fudge a 1-to-5 if you finish the video at 24, but that can look a little stuttery, and I don't always like... Again, that depends on your lighting. I have this one shot, and I use it over and over and over again, and it's so simple. It's an old beat-up butterfly. Just lifting off from a bush, flying to the other side. I got too close to it. It kind of freaked it out. 120 frame per second 4K video, I can use that. It looks real good when you mix it in with footage that is going to finish at like 1080p from mirrorless, standalone mirrorless cameras. It looks good in 4K. It looks great opposite a 1080p sort of final render from much, much nicer hardware. That's the kind of stuff that gets me excited. That makes slow motion video practical. It makes it more interesting to use. It makes it more interesting. It's not just a gimmick that you're going to throw away. And same thing, like, I was joking around with my wife, because I don't know that she really does watch all of the family videos that I cut. I know she does. But I made a passing reference to our Easter egg hunt from earlier this year, and I shot all of that 4K, 120 frame per second from the OnePlus 9 Pro. And then I slowed it all way down and I put it to like an opera background, and it's just these little girls like just brutally fighting each other to like yank these Easter eggs. And there's just something so fresh. That video is so crisp. It is such high quality. And then when you slow it down to 1/4 speed, it's so dramatic. Little girls reaching for plastic Easter eggs now takes on the weight and the majesty of like brutal gladiator competition, and setting it to opera just makes the whole thing hilarious. And you're like, that's not something I can do on a Samsung. That would have been garbage footage shot 720p, you know, like it wouldn't have been as funny or as bold or as dramatic if it weren't in 4K. So that kind of stuff to me, that's what I hope. We'll keep getting those features, even though they're going to run, the marketing is going to run roughshod over, you know, more megapixels. You don't need them, but you've got them now. What can you do with them? Nobody knows. From Build Monkey. Let's chat this. Hold on real quick. Would you recommend getting an LG V60 still? I'm finding it really hard to upgrade from my G7 as I feel I'm losing features moving to anything new. So like any other fire sale device, I had the same recommendation for the Razer Phone 2 back in the day. You know, a year after they discontinued the Razer Phone line, you could pick up a Razer for like $399. And at the same time, that was kind of the price of a Pixel 4a. So do you value the more immediate and probably the better polish on software updates, or do you want that baller hardware for cheap? LG's been doing a pretty good job. I've been keeping sort of a death watch, and when the Xperia 1 comes back in, I'm going to just sort of round robin through the LGs again. I think I might actually call that video LG Death Watch. The V60 is, I believe, on the August security patch. The Velvet is up to date. And there are some rumblings about the Android 11 update for the Wing finally making it out to some of the South Korean variants. So I don't know if that's going to be coming to my Verizon model soon. The security patching has actually been pretty solid. And the bug fixes, like the V60 had a really bad gremlin for CPU management that tanked battery life. They patched it reasonably quickly, considering it was LG. I doubt that's going to last for very much longer, like maybe over the next year. And then I'm still not hyper confident on any kind of timely operating system updates for LG phones. But if you're cool kind of riding the older software, the hardware deal that you can get, like here in the United States, it's not terrifically difficult finding an LG V60 for like $380 and not like used and beat up, like refurbed or new in box under $400. That is an enormous amount of phone for $400. So it's always pros and cons. But if you're good on the hardware, I mean, if you're good on the software side, the hardware side is kind of ridiculous.
Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a megapixel coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious megapixels. Head on over to somegadgetguy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
Oh, is the P12, is there an actual Lenovo tablet that wasn't just like someone guessing about an Android tablet? Lenovo actually does have one out. I don't know these things. I am not up to date on Moto and Lenovo. I used to have a really good relationship. I reached out to them and their PR was like, hey, Juan, yeah, we haven't talked in a while. Let's chat about some things to do. And I sent them a follow-up and they're like, we don't cover those things. I was like, hey, what's going on? I'd love to talk about, if you can put me in touch with someone about Moto, and I've got all these products for Ready 4 and desktop modes. We don't cover those. Use the PR email, PR at Motorola. Cool. I guess we won't work together anymore. Is fine. So I'm just shopping out, you know, whenever I kind of make it through this deluge, I might just try and like buy a Moto just to play with Ready 4, and then I'll sell it or give it away or something. I don't want to have to play that game because I hate, you know, like using the gadget budget just to kind of throw a phone away. But right now, Moto doesn't seem particularly interested in working with me, or Lenovo to that degree anymore, which is a bummer. There was a first time comment, and I lost it in my ability to put it up, from Mama at Papa Mo. I don't know how you say your name. Is the HDR trend going to continue, or are we going to get some more realistic photos, less harsh HDR, less sharpening, and less processing? So I would imagine the HDR trend in photography is going to run roughshod over, like social media photos. Like even Apple is leaning way more aggressively into juicy, hyped color, light, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Remember, we used to praise like, oh, the iPhone camera, it's so much more natural, until like the white balance changed on you and it would turn a shadowed shot into like icy blue cold winter. Apple has never really been amazing at that. I always think it's fun. You get the best photos. It's just so, it just works. It really doesn't. I feel like the auto modes are going to increasingly lean into more aggressive and colorful post-processing, because that is reinforced by the positive feedback you get on social media. So the brighter and the more vivid those colors and those images pop on Instagram, the more the camera manufacturers are going to include them as the default settings. But when you look at things like X-Pan on the OnePlus 9 Pro, or the Hasselblad color science in the Pro version of the app, what I'm hoping is that we'll still continue to see that separation, that there's less aggressive AI, HDR, auto color enhancements being added to the raw capture. So you can take that really high quality raw image data and do whatever you want with it. And I know a lot of people say, oh, you got to edit photos or really do those things. And you're like, working on a Sony kind of highlights how stupid tech reviewers are. Every individual goes through some kind of editing, cropping, or filtering. If average consumers weren't leaning hard into photo editing, Instagram wouldn't have a full featured suite of filters and editing tools to use in their upload. Like, that's basic. That's average consumer. Everyone's trying to make their images stand out. Everyone's trying to tell a unique story. That's basic. So you take a shot from a Sony Xperia and it doesn't magically have the good colors baked in. How could anyone use this camera? Can't tell me people are going to sit there and edit. Except that they do. Oh my God, you're so dumb if you're telling that to people. I'm so tired of like tech reviewers acting like this is an average consumer photography experience. Like, I'm just going to point the phone, I'm going to push a shutter button, and now I'm just going to upload. I can't even look at it. I just got to upload it directly to Instagram. Did it have the good colors? There's no way to know. I'm average consumer. Stop talking down to people like they're idiots. Average consumers are already doing phenomenally more with their phones than tech reviewers do. And tech reviewers like lean on it because they've got thousands of dollars of photography, camera, and video production equipment. So of course, they're not trying to do as much from their phone cameras, but the average people who don't have $5,000 camera bodies are doing more from their phone cameras and also doing more post on their images than any tech reviewer is, with the exception of a handful of like really hardcore photography focused kinds of individuals. Like off the top of my head, shout out Nick Gray. You want to talk about a tech reviewer who really does literally show all his work in a camera comparison? Go check out Fandroid. Because he's not there doing like, I took three photos in the worstest conditions just to show you that the photos aren't good enough. He's actually going through and like, especially on like Pixel 4a, Pixel 5a, head-to-head against a $1,000 phone, head-to-head against a $1,200 phone. These are real photos that he takes with his family. So you can see kids in action. Nick Gray, GOAT. A lot of other tech reviewers, knuckle-draggingly stupid. I'm being very uncharitable. and it's fun. Oh, Russ, Google will never give us a headphone jack on the Pixel 6. Sorry, I kind of blew out my voice getting to the end of my oxygen on that last little rant there. Oh, there was the comment from Mama at Papamo. From Bray Gray, I do hope the Pixel does 4K 24 frames per second. I understand the hardware strain of 4K 60 120, but 4K 24 shouldn't be too hard to throw in. I think one of the reasons why we've seen the walk away from 24 frames per second on these larger camera sensors is dealing with light. If you want a better breakdown on camera sensors, catch my video, because I think there's a very good reason to not shoot 24 on a phone unless you can properly control light in your surroundings. And that becomes more of a studio or a production concern. And if that's the case, then unfortunately, I got to say, you got to go Xperia or you got to use Filmic. But I don't think the stock camera apps are going to keep doing it because of the larger image sensors. Let me scroll down here. From McCorkran. Again, this is such a nerdy thing to say, and I totally feel it. This is why I like having two phones. I use one for hardware and one for up-to-date software. In my heart of hearts, when I'm not reviewing devices, I tend to keep like a really, really nice premium workhorse device and then something like a Pixel 3a. Like if I go down to the beach, I don't want to take a super, super nice phone or a phone with hinges or a phone that swivels or a phone that bends or folds or flexes. I want my Pixel. My Pixel goes down with me to the beach because the Pixel's cheap and I don't care if it gets messed up. So that's usually in my brain. I want my really, really, really nice work phone and then my I can beat it up weekender phone. And Alsa Bakli, absolutely. A couple other people have mentioned this too. We need an embedded ND filter for the most for pro use in today's camera phones. Having to crank up the shutter to 100,000, one 100,000th of a second is really bad for cinematic look. And that's probably why 24 frames per second isn't really being utilized. Some jokes at Apple's expense for ProRes, but then not really. Let's see. Greg. Greg is in the chat. Everyone say, hey, Greg, go with the international or EU model LG and you can unlock the bootloader. That's good to know. Steve from Q3 Becker, Lenovo makes great budget tablets, and I completely agree. I didn't know that they had a new, is it a new nicer tablet? Had no idea. I guess it's called the P12 Pro. So I'll have to look it up. Again, I'm not even on Lenovo's mailing list. I reached out to them to say, hey, I want to cover your products. They don't even send me press releases. So that's kind of a bummer. And Trey, apparently everyone has tablets all of a sudden. I think this is a market in transition. I think a number of manufacturers are looking at, hey, it's really hard for us to get out there and sell phones, but maybe we can sell a companion product or an accessory or some other type of computing device. We can sell it really cheap. We don't have to worry about as much carrier restrictions or approvals or any of the certifications. You know, it's okay if we maybe bypass a cell phone radio on this one flavor of it, or we only get someone with a Wi-Fi model. I think those types of things are being re-examined in this current climate of consumerism. If we can't convince someone to flip their phone every year or every other year, hey, this would be a really good time to get someone stoked about a new tablet, though. And there's not a ton of competition for Android tablets. Hey, let's try and push. You know, let's you know, we can point to a Galaxy Tab and say, well, hey, do you want to spend $700? Probably not. And I feel like some of the most successful versions of that in the past now aren't really competing in the space anymore, like the MatePads, the Huawei's. We still have an old Huawei MatePad, one of the mid-ranger MatePads, and it's got stylus support. It is a great tablet still. And Lex has battered that thing all across our home. DTNL. Some really funny stuff in there. Some comments on Austin Evans' review. I just said, like, hey, Fandroid, Nick Gray, you want to see some camera comparisons, wholeheartedly shout that guy out. If you're talking PC components, right now, my top two, and this isn't to say there aren't others, but the top two that I tend to circle around are Hardware Unboxed and Gamer's Nexus. Again, you're going to watch a Gamer's Nexus video, and it's not going to be entertaining. And there isn't going to be a ton of B-roll. And the graphs are really complicated. And if you want good data, you have to sacrifice all of the time it takes to produce the video B-roll to do your damn job. Every second you spend panning a phone through a beautiful field or a busy city landscape with an amazing camera is a second you're not really using the product to develop the opinion you have on that product. And so I am sort of Twitter-pated with Hardware Unboxed and Gamer's Nexus. They have labs, they've got facilities, they've got a good studio, they shoot practical B-roll, so you get those close-ups on the products that you need just to help fulfill the information they're delivering, and they could care not at all about making their look more cinematic. You really want a picture of a glowing rectangular display. I mean, I would watch, I mean, the data's good, but I can't watch it unless it's a cinematic shot. So dumb. All right. I'm so way behind on this chat here. I'm really bad at doing like the Q&A chat catch up. Yeah, Gabaletta. Again, it's such a hypocrisy. Massively huge tech channels have thousands of dollars in the camera gear and still tell people that $1,000 phone is not worth it because it's not as good as the phone they use on the daily. I feel like that irony should be sort of highlighted a bit more. Let's see. Oh, from Fat Produce, like, just kind of changing subject here. I've seen a ton of people lately rocking Aftershock's bone conduction headphones. Seems to correspond with Best Buy having working displays of the headphones for people to try out. I have seen so many Aftershocks in our neighborhood. I can think off the top of my head three parents that have kids that go to Lex's school that I've seen wearing Aftershocks. And I've noticed a couple people sort of walking around. Now, kind of compare that against the conversation for true wireless. Like, oh, I need this case and I need earbuds and I've got to like handle it and take care of them and charge this and then charge them. And it's just so much more convenient having three batteries and I can lose one earbud more easily and I don't have a place to keep them if I just want to take them and put them in a pocket. Aftershocks are pretty practical. And if you want open ear, bone conduction is pretty rad. So situational awareness, better than a lot of other earbuds. Excuse me. I'm just saying, I'm a big fan. Aeropex were really good. Even the Trex Air, so good. Trex Titanium were pretty good too. They're just a little heavier. Scrolling through the chat. Do. Adita Anil is plugging my camera sensor video because he's a rad dude. Greg, P11 Pro, Chromebook Duet. Oh, CopyCash, the Lenovo Duet Lenovo's Chromebook Duet has gotten great reviews too. They have a new one coming out next month. You know, I need to catch up on Chrome OS gear too. I'm a little behind. I've been rocking that Pixelbook for so long that I've been sated, and I haven't really been digging deeper into some of the competing Chrome OS devices. Scrolling down. Okay, so for Vazicose 8, I actually just did a little research on this. I'm waiting for 4K OLEDs for tablets and Nex docks. Expect to wait for a little ways longer yet. A company just reached out to me that I cannot remember their name now. Arg. But they sell portable monitors and they've got some portable battery powered OLEDs to the tune of like $500 to $700. So I always think it's hilarious when someone complains about a Next dock. You're like, oh, $300, you could just buy a Chromebook. It should be better with OLEDs and batteries, and it should be wireless, and it's its own computer. And you're like, you're an idiot. Stop being dumb. This stuff gets ridiculously more expensive when you try to act like it would just be so easy to put an OLED in. I'm not saying you're doing this, by the way, Vazikos. I know you're not making this argument. I'm not trying to use my dumb voice for your comment here. Right now, a battery-powered portable OLED, minimum $500. Minimum. And you're going to see people say, well, like, well, if you're already going to spend $500, why wouldn't you just get a Galaxy Tab? And you're like, yeah, that's why Galaxy Tabs are expensive. The nicer gear and building in any kind of profit buffer into that product is going to make it more expensive. So when I pull out, like, I've got the YouPerfect X Pro, and it's a really nice portable battery-powered monitor, ports and inputs. It's got that keyboard blade that's all surface style. Like, that is a really nice version, desktop version of a Next Dock or a YouPerfect. But it's so expensive. It's like $500. Show me what combination of products can be as beautifully clean and simple, live on a desk, look just as nice, and come in at a lower price tag. I know you can go and get a $30 laptop hub and a portable display and your own portable keyboard and mouse, and that's not gonna look as nice on someone's desk. It's not. It's not gonna be as convenient. It's not gonna fold up as small. It's not gonna be as manageable or as portable. Show me where you can really put all those things together and do it for cheaper, because you can't. And that's where we're gonna be. Like, getting a really nice portable OLED would be sweet. But I think, like, because I do remember one of the announcements on one of the Lenovo tablets or laptops or Chromebooks or something was HDMI input. So double duty like that, you can kind of have, like, a good mid-range powered Android tablet or a portable display. I'm really hoping that kind of stuff becomes more popular. I'm going to scroll down to the bottom of the chat and then just kind of scroll up and catch a few, see if we missed any really, really juicy, tasty hot takes here. From Russ, do you still have an LG V50 and LG G8? The selfie camera on the V50 struggles to focus, but the G8 surprisingly has manual focus, which is so good. Does yours do that too? I'd have to take a look. I don't remember manual focus on the G8. But I'm also the wrong person to ask about selfie cameras because I actively try to never use them. Anytime you see a selfie from me, 99 times out of 100, it's rear camera. So I hold up the rear camera and I take a photo, because if you're going to see this visage, it has to be captured from the best camera I have access to. This will never be captured by one of the inferior cameras on one of my portable devices. I mean, when you want this, you want it all. Actually, maybe I should start shooting more from the selfie cameras. from a DTNL, and I feel like, you know, let's wrap this up, because I know I'm already kind of now pushing a little past 2 hours. This is going to be another 2.5 hour podcast. I don't do kind of the catch up Q&As as much as I probably should. Aditya asks, Juan, in the chat, I've seen lots of folks talking about rocking two daily driver phones. Is that the new norm? Real quick, I'm going to explain mine. I want to see in the chat, please drop the comment right now. Have you normalized dual devices in your daily driver setup? Also, have any of your family members who aren't techies like us, have any of them started trying or flirting with multiple devices? For me, I'm almost always reviewing some kind of product. This has actually been one of the longest kind of lulls in between phone reviews that I've ever had since talking about phones. So for me, typically, for example, I'll highlight this. Pixel 5a had my SIM card for the last couple weeks. It's now back in my OnePlus 9 Pro, and before that it was in my LG V60. I almost always have two phones because I want to be able to sort of compare in a moment when I have an idea. So for me, lately, obviously, a major talking point for me has been camera performance and sensor sizes. So while I had the Pixel 5a, I always wanted to have a larger sensor camera to back up my hypothesis or to get data for my hypothesis. Shooting photos out in the park, Pixel 5a versus OnePlus 9 Pro. How much difference are we really going to see in something that's going to be squashed to hell on Instagram? I know that's not always the best argument, but I wanted to detail what those differences really look like in real world performance. For a long time, my previous workhorse phone, actually still one of my current workhorse phones, is the V60. When I hold that up against a OnePlus 9 Pro, I find many places where the Pro can't really hang with my workflow, and I need to go back to a V60. So that helps inform the conversation. If it weren't for that review style, for me, it would really be older mid-ranger beater phone for more weekender kind of use, and then really, really nice phone for when I need to get my work done. And in my use, that would probably be a 60-40. Now, 60% of the time, I'd have my SIM card in the nicer phone, and 40% of the time, I just need to take phone calls. I need to be able to communicate. I've got a nice camera on there. I can kind of take some snapshots. It's going to be in the beater phone. And I also get kind of lazy too. Like, am I switching my watch every time? Because I hate having to repair my watch. So my preferred combo would be two smartwatches, two phones, but not always taking both of them out at the same time. So let's see what some of the comments have to say. Who was that? Like, Russ says a Galaxy S7 and a classic Nokia. Gary the Fireman saying 100% yes. I totally get that. Fat Produce, honestly, I still use one phone at a time, and I also use my tablet, so some other type of computing device. JMX Warrior saying SIM 1 and 2 in the same phone for a while, but SIM 2, the SIM 2's home is the Note 9. That's actually another good point there too, is I only part-time multiple SIM cards. I don't rock multiple SIMs all the time. So a dual SIM phone doesn't have as much of a draw. For me, it's literally abuse. If I want one phone to have less abuse, I need one phone that will be abused more. And that's a terrible way to say that. From Gabaletta, I've been using two devices for the past 3 to 4 years. I carry a Note and an LG all the time. Tiger Kim is saying, nope, just one phone unless you include a work phone. Well, that would be including you do carry two phones, or you have access to two phones. My wife is like that. She has a personal phone and a work-issued phone. And she keeps those very, very separate. And Russ also saying, I enjoy having a standalone tablet. Gary the Fireman saying, no one else in my family uses two phones. I know my brother has a hard time keeping one phone operational. So he almost, like, it's kind of a coin flip whether or not he even has a working phone. My sister, her husband, they're still on Pixel 3As. My dad is on the Pixel 4A. My mom on the OnePlus 6. My cousin's on the iPhone 11 Pro. I can't think of any of my family, my immediate, like, my close family members that have two devices. I think the closest was my cousin. She's on an iPhone 11 Pro now. She did pick up an iPhone SE and a Google Fi SIM card while she was traveling internationally before the pandemic broke out. And then I think she sold that phone when she got back. So she didn't even keep her second phone. She didn't want to travel with a really nice, expensive, come mug me kind of phone. So at the time, she didn't have a really nice phone at the time. She purposely bought a cheaper iPhone. It might not have been the SE. might have been an iPhone 8. She purposely bought a cheaper iPhone, used that internationally, came back, sold it, and then bought her iPhone 11 Pro instead. Yeah, TK. Same thing with my wife. My wife and I have, on average, two phones, a work line and a personal line. So same thing with my wife. She's the only one I know that has a separate work phone line, work-issued phone. A lot of my other family members have done a BYOD, which to me makes no sense. I would never want any company, no matter how well that company treated me, I would never want them to have any kind of interaction with my own personal device. But I'm super paranoid. Oh, hey, Southern. Southern says, I'm using the LG V60 and a Galaxy Z Fold 3 right now. That's a killer combo. Those are two brutal premium devices. Kenox is saying, nope, a phone and a tablet. So two computing devices, but not two phones. Anderspand is saying, two phones, three SIM cards, LG V60, dual display, LG Velvet, dual display, and DS4. Display mania! Vazico's, hey, older phones for the beach. I totally grok that. Other than one phone with split screen multitasking. Let's see. And Trey, oh my God, yes, why do we have to reset the smartwatch every time we want to repair it? I really wish this watch would just exist as its own standalone Android device, and there could be a different handshake if I wanted to switch to another phone. And Fat Produce also saying the same thing. Having to repair the watch is the biggest headache for using two phones. Let's see. Oh, and Aditya, another reply here. Why isn't it clicking? Oh, let's try that. Nope, still not coming up. Let me read this off. As a university student, I often lack the luxury of having two phones, but I also do have a tablet. I'm a person, so I understand. It was just mildly frustrating seeing phones that did almost everything for $600 get replaced by either a two-phone solution or a phone-plus-tablet solution that tends to cost more than $600. It's very good consumerism. It's very good for capitalism, but it's real frustrating, and I definitely share that frustration. Again, there's so many things a V60 can do that no other device can, and the phone was not the most expensive phone of 2020. It was a very reasonably priced premium tier device for 2020. Oh, Trey. So, I mean, again, man, Trey saying work keeps wanting to upgrade my work phone, but they can pry the Touch ID out of my cold, dead hands. My wife is on an iPhone 8, and she's kind of like that phone. Again, she abuses her phones. Like it's aging not very gracefully in her keep. So her work was kind of talking about the same, like, hey, maybe we could go to an iPhone 12. And she said, no, do not do that. And I keep feeling like if you were rocking Touch ID, it might be worth it to pick up an iPhone SE. If it's just the work phone, if it's just like that kind of communication, you're keeping it separate, you're not really living your life out of it, you can kind of manage the increased power draw of the more powerful processor, that could be a good fit. I'm talking to her about maybe trying to do the same thing. Just flip the iPhone 8 for an iPhone SE. And then even her current cases are still going to fit. Like, she won't even have to buy a new phone case. She can just keep rocking the same gear. Let's see. Fat Produce. I'm breaking out an old Samsung Gear Fit 2 Pro just because my Gear S3 Frontier is so big it's starting to hurt my wrist again. Where did I found it? I have the Gear S2 smartwatch, the one that's basically a mini phone, and like they actually curved the huge rectangular lump. I need to fire it up and see if it still works. Because if it does, I might try and see if I can pair it up with my Galaxy S10. And that'll be my Samsung combo. Ridiculous bangle of an old Galaxy smartwatch and a two-year-old Galaxy phone. And I'll pop a SIM card in my phone, be right as rain. It's so ridiculous. Yeah, what I would love to do is take that Gear S... I think it's the Gear S2 or the Gear S. or the Gear LTE, whatever it was called. I would love to take that back in time to like when the first iPhone launched, because we were right at that consumer curve where consumers were all really hyped up on the absolute smallest regular cell phones that they could get, right? There was that joke in Zoolander about a cell phone so small, like you could swallow it, right? I would love to go back in time there and say, hey, look at these really cool smartphones that are coming out. In the future, they all get smaller too, and show them like this super teeny tiny smartwatch. But then it's like, it's just a trying to pretend it's a phone, because on the back it even has like the SIM card tray, so you could say like SIM cards got smaller, so we could make our cell phones even smaller. And look, it even has a little keyboard if you want to type messages to your friends. I would love to like, I need to invent time travel just so I can screw with people. But again, like, so if you're rocking multiple smartwatches, I would recommend having a really, really nice, like, premium, like, smart computing device, and then grab yourself, like, a less expensive fitness tracker. And then that combo, great. I finally found, I lost my Amazfit, so I've got the T-Rex over on the desk. I found it this morning. I was like, ah! So I'm going to charge up my T-Rex, and I'll have a T-Rex and a Tick Watch, and that's a good combo. Moving back and forth where I can kind of more easily swap the fitness tracker with other phones when I need to review them, and then I can kind of keep a more main daily driver paired up with my Tick Watch. It's good times. I hate having to wipe out my watch for Wear OS. So I think on that note, we should probably start wrapping this up. Folks, thanks so much. This was a fun kind of diversion from my normal podcast schedule. And like I said, I wanted to have a little bit more fun, even though there is some still some heavy news out there, some really concerning ideas. I know my tech review schedule has been completely upside down and inside out. And getting back to finding the tech conversations that I enjoy and knowing that the YouTube algorithm is going to destroy them, it's definitely been a refreshing change of pace from feeling the obligation of always having to jump through the hoops of trying to figure out what's going to make the most popular and sort of the most SEO friendly impact on my channel. So, I'm going to have a bunch of stuff coming out this week. I've got some accessory reviews, some earbud reviews. I've got another sort of hands-on, I don't know if I'm going to make it a video, but it might end up being a written editorial on somegadgetguide.com. Just talking again about utilizing our products more fully. And hopefully this will also have a little bit more audience interaction. So fingers crossed it makes it into some sort of written editorial form. But along the way, it's really just, I want to have more fun. I want to not be so cranky and complainy all the time, and this has been kind of the fun way of accomplishing that. So, oh, and then I'm also going to have another video coming out on reviews.org. I think it's going to release tomorrow, so just be on the lookout for that too. My side gig of also being a pundit and talking about the wireless and broadband industry. If you ever needed to fill your entire waking day with the sound of my voice, I am working really hard to facilitate that. So folks, thank you so much for jumping in, for joining, for chatting, and really getting to have that really great back and forth, that Q&A on stream. I want you to have an amazing week. I want you to do awesome with your technology. I want you to be awesome with your technology. And I'll catch you all back here next week for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SDGQA podcast channel. Take care. Be well. Take care of yourselves, both mentally and physically. I'll catch you back here next week. I love y'all. Bye-bye.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take better photos. Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.